Welcome to season 5 of Overcoming Child Sexual Abuse. This season, we have a fantastic lineup of world-renowned experts and guests as we continue our journey of healing, growing, and thriving beyond child sexual abuse and trauma. Throughout this season, we're going to take an even deeper dive into new knowledge and insights, and we're going to explore even more practices that can help us each day to shift the way we feel in our minds and our bodies, so we can move through each day in the driver's seat on this journey and be free to make choices to step into all the happiness and well-being we want in our lives. Today, Dr. Arielle Schwartz returns to join us, and we're talking about her two most recent books that continue to help us overcome the impacts of childhood trauma in our adult lives. Dr. Schwartz is a renowned trauma expert, licensed psychologist, registered yoga teacher, and prolific author. And Dr. Schwartz joined us previously as a guest in season 2. In Dr. Schwartz's Therapeutic Yoga for Trauma Recovery flip chart, released in August of last year, we're given an array of yoga, breathing, and meditative practices to balance, energize, and calm the body, especially to help overcome the impacts of trauma on our minds and our bodies. In her just released book, Applied Polyvagal Theory in Yoga, Therapeutic Practices for Emotional Health, Dr. Schwartz takes us into a deeper dive to understand the interrelationships between mind, emotions, physiology, and behavior, and introduces us to practices that aid us in rewiring our nervous systems, including vagal toning, conscious breathing, mindful movement, and meditation, all of which combine to cultivate a felt sense of ease and safety, enhance our capability to handle challenges, and recover from stress and anxiety quickly and efficiently. When I learned of Dr. Schwartz's new books, I couldn't wait to work through them and to invite Dr. Schwartz to talk with us once more, because I knew we would gain great new learning and new practices to help us on our continuing journeys. And so I'm incredibly grateful that Dr. Schwartz has taken the time amidst her consuming schedule to join us today. Welcome, Dr. Arielle Schwartz.
Thank you, Kathy. It's so lovely to be back with you.
I'm so grateful for you to be back with us since your last time with us on the podcast. And since that time, you have two new books out. First, you have your flip chart for Therapeutic Yoga for Trauma Recovery, which came out in August last year, only seems like yesterday. And second, Applied Polyvagal Theory in Yoga, that is coming out in April of this year. And, you know, I have to say, your books are so much more than books. They are really incredible practical tools that so powerfully help those of us who have experienced trauma to shift out of a place of trauma and into a space of healing and release and expansion through very trauma-informed practices. And you share that you were really driven to make these practices and the knowledge behind the practices accessible online with the shutdown of studios that started during COVID, but that really remains such an essential way to reach so many of us who need easy access to practices that we can use every day. And you highlight in your upcoming book that, quote, "The purpose of this book is to provide simple interventions to facilitate greater mind-body wellness and honing in on where science, soma, and soul meet." Can you talk about why these books and why now?
Yeah, thank you. There was a lot in that introduction, Kathy, and I feel like I want to unpack a few of the key elements to what you just asked. The first is why mind-body wellness versus such an emphasis, I think, in our current mental health world that focuses on the reduction of symptoms of illness. And a wellness model is really quite different than an illness or a medical model. And that rather than focusing on removing the symptoms, we actually focus on enhancing well-being and the felt sense of well-being. When we look at the core definition of health, even from the World Health Organization, it's not simply the removal of distressing symptoms that we're after. It's actually the presence of well-being that facilitates that felt experience of health in the world. And I think especially now, because there is so much chaos and there are so many threats that our nervous systems and bodies and minds are navigating literally each and every day. You turn on the news, you look at what's happening out in the world or in your own community or in your own home, in your own body. At every level, we might be interfacing with challenge. So the intention behind these, really all of the books that I have out there, and certainly these two most recent and forthcoming products, are really about what do we do? How can I maximize this? How can I bring practices into my daily life? Because we can come away with so much theoretical knowledge, but if we can't put it into practice, then it's just a lot of words, honestly. And so my intention is to ground theory and science into something that we can ourselves embody and know step by step how to get to know our nervous system and how to connect to our breath, how to safely re-embody in a way that doesn't leave us feeling flooded. There's one more piece in what you named, which is about that connection between the science and soma and soul. And I think about that kind of like a triple Venn diagram where the space where those three meet, this intersection between the study and the physiology and understanding polyvagal theory, for example, really getting to know that science. And then the soma being about the body and embodiment and movement and breath. And then there's the unmeasurable. Then there is the ephemeral. And we, in a sense, can transcend into the language of the soul within psychology. It's built right in there. Psyche, if you look at its the Greek origin of the word, is often translated as the soul. But so much of psychology has become kind of soulless and it's protocolized and again, it's medicalized. So the intention of this intersection of science, soma, and soul is to actually recenter that deeper inquisition that we have, that inquiry that we have with ourselves of why am I here? What gives me meaning? What is my purpose? How do I understand the language of the psyche that comes through symbol and that comes through dreams and it comes through a longing that we have for something more? So I call this intersection where those three spheres meet embodied spirituality. And that's what this whole model is about. And in a sense, yoga, which is what these latest books are really centered around, is about union. And it's about coming home to that felt experience that we can hold through that union, something so big, something so even scary or overwhelming or contradictory and paradoxical as this human experience. And that soul layer or that union allows us to transcend all of those specific pieces into the big picture.
And that's what I love about these two books in particular is the flip chart is an amazing tool and it's so simple. you have managed to take what some, many people feel, I can't get into yoga, it's too difficult, I don't know where to start, it's too complicated every day, and you've broken it down to very simple practices that you can step into very easily, yet are so powerful. And so it creates that space to have that connection with source, that, as you said, the beautiful term, embodied spirituality. But then at the same time, you have the upcoming book that goes into polyvagal theory so that we can understand it. We can get that psychoeducation, if you will, so that our mind can make sense of things as our bodies are sensing things, right?
The whole model of the applied polyvagal theory in yoga, which is actually what all of my books on yoga are rooted in, is this understanding that we need to attend to the state of our nervous system as a foundation. Am I keyed up in anxiety? Am I in my sympathetic nervous system? Is there a lot of cortisol that's flooding through me? Am I feeling in some way keyed up or overwhelmed? Or am I in some way or another feeling fatigued, shut down, withdrawn, collapsed in some way, the urge to hide, the urge to withdraw, and that the information about our nervous system actually serves underneath any diagnosis, underneath any challenge that we're having, it actually allows us to attend to these basics, understanding that most of our symptoms, our mental health challenges, are rooted in imbalances within the autonomic nervous system. And so once we know the state of our nervous system, we can start to introduce practices that help us to find greater balance within the autonomic nervous system. So if I'm feeling more of that hypoarousal and that shutdown, I can actually upregulate my nervous system into more alertness. And if I'm feeling more keyed up, like I can never stop and rest or slow down, I can use practices that help downregulate my nervous system into greater balance.
Yeah. And so let's talk about that for a moment in the context of what is trauma? Because much of the awareness that we need comes from the fact that our trauma, unresolved trauma, shows up in our bodies. And, you know, you talk about, for example, that trauma is not the event itself. It is what happens within you in response to the event. And, you know, you go on to talk about, and I love this phrase in the flip chart, that our issues are in our tissues, you know, that those post-traumatic stress symptoms show up in our bodies through the nervous system. So can you talk about that in the context of how especially our childhood trauma plays into that?
Yes. So when we think about a traumatic event, maybe as a basic definition, we can really back up into anything that overwhelms us and that we don't have the resources to necessarily process or digest at the time that it occurs. You know, even a child who experiences a traumatic event, the research shows that if that child has a caring, loving parent, a caring, loving adult that is able to show up with them, that's able to help them process through their emotions, talk about it if they have language, restore a sense of safety, restore a sense of connection, that child generally can have a pretty resilient response to a traumatic event. However, it's when traumatic events are either ongoing or repeated, or they're large enough and we have nobody that can help us make sense of that. Nobody to talk to, nobody to turn to, nobody that believes us, right? All of the challenges that can happen, especially with childhood trauma. And so then, you know, if we think about I love to use the digestive system as a metaphor for trauma in the sense that an event happens, let's say we ingest something, a meal, right? If that meal has gone bad, if the food has gone sour, our bodies have a very instinctual response to those toxins or the food poisoning that says, get this out of me. This is not digestible. And when we've experienced something traumatic, in a sense, it lands in us like an undigestible meal, like a meal that's gone bad. Our bodies have an instinctual response that says, yuck, no, I don't want this. I don't want this to become part of me. In contrast, let's just look at eating a very nourishing meal, right? Our bodies still will assimilate and differentiate that of any experience that we take in from the world, that which nourishes us, those are the nutrients that we're going to take in and allow to help become building blocks for who we are. And then we're going to differentiate that which is waste. So our digestive system or our gut belly brain, if you want to think about it that way, is very wise. Our bodies are very wise in helping us navigate the world. And when it comes to life events, some life events become parts of us in a way that we can assimilate that and say, yes, I want to integrate that kindness from this person or that those caring actions or that wisdom. I want to integrate those experiences that I've taken in interpersonally or that I've experienced in the world and make those part of me. And then we have traumatic events and we say, no, that doesn't feel intrinsic to who I am. That feels like waste. Maybe it's not even a trauma, but it's just an extraneous, not me, right? Our gut can help us go me and not me. And we can start to learn to listen to that intrinsic wisdom that lives inside of us. I think that's what I love about yoga and embodiment practices is that it gives us the opportunity to slow down and to mindfully track how is my body responding to the events of my day or my, you know, my week or something that happened many, many years ago.
Yeah. And a key part of that is what we know to be the vagus nerve, right? The vagal nerve that runs through us like an information superhighway, right? And a lot of what your practice and work is about is letting us know and showing us how we can be the driver in that information superhighway. We don't have to be overwhelmed by the different emotional states. Can you talk a little bit about that nerve, that system, just so, you know, everyone kind of has a good understanding of what that is, how it affects us, and how we can, again, be the driver?
Absolutely. So the vagus nerve is our 10th cranial nerve. This particular nerve was given the name vagus. It stands for wandering in Latin. That's how it's translated. And all of our other cranial nerves are pretty localized around the head or kind of in the upper regions close to the brain. However, the vagus nerve is different in that it travels, it wanders, and it travels all the way down through your larynx and pharynx in your throat, through your heart and lungs, and then down past your diaphragm into your digestive organs and reproductive organs. So it really kind of infiltrates into our abdomen where the other cranial nerves do not go. So this idea of it being this mind-body superhighway is that it will help connect that gut-belly wisdom or that intrinsic nervous system up to the brain that we have in our heads. It will gather that information and basically travel that information back and forth in ways that it does so quite automatically. So if we're perceiving a threat, for example, we generally don't have to think about how our nervous system needs to respond to that threat. If we did, it would take too long. We want to be able to respond to a threat in a fraction of a second because that helps us protect ourselves. And the vagus nerve will gather information from our senses and our interoceptive felt experience in the body and work with the brain to help you respond to that threat as necessary. And conversely, the vagus nerve helps us recognize when we're safe, find those cues of safety, and helps to downregulate out of a threat response so that we can go into our rest and digest response or a relaxation response. Now, the vagus nerve is an interesting piece because it serves like a metaphorical break. And if you think about our threat response system, that's generally our fight-flight system, and it's driven by the other side of the autonomic nervous system. It's our sympathetic nervous system. That's our go. That's our adrenaline, our cortisol. It's going to help us protect ourselves. But the vagus nerve plays such a key role because it functions like this metaphorical brake pedal. So if the sympathetic is our gas pedal, for example, when we know that we're safe enough, the vagus nerve helps put the brakes on that sympathetic system so that we can slow down and gain the benefits of rest or sleep well at night or meditate, and even enhances creative states when we feel safe enough to rest inside of that felt sense of well-being. But the vagus nerve also can lift off, which helps us then mobilize in response to a threat. But here's the key thing. We can also, when we perceive safety, we can kind of fine-tune that gas brake connection, right? We can fine-tune that engagement of the vagus nerve so that we can have just enough mobilization in the context of safety, which lets us do things like play or dance or have a really fun yoga practice where we're moving on our mat or climb a mountain or go paddleboarding, which I know you love.
I do. That's where I first listened to your book, Paddleboarding on a Lake.
It's beautiful. And, you know, and the other side of this is that when we look at how the vagus nerve works with the other cranial nerves, the upper pathway of the vagus nerve combines or communicates with other cranial nerves. And so it gathers information from the face and our eyes and our ears and our mouth and our tongue. And this upper vagal pathway that travels above the diaphragm, but especially up into your face, is what Stephen Porges refers to as our social engagement system. And our social engagement system it's really only found in mammals, and it plays a really key role in our sense of well-being because it helps us tune into cues of safety and connection through our relationships that once again allows us to engage that vagal brake, to come out of a threat response so that we can find deep connection and intimacy and meaningful, loving relationships.
And that's where, again, your flip chart and the book that kind of gives us the knowledge behind it gives us practices and helps us understand those practices so we can be better at putting on the brake and releasing the brake and putting on the accelerator. And so you have some balancing practices, you have some calming practices, and you have some energizing practices in the flip chart, and then explained more in the book. So can you talk about, for example, some of your balancing practices, those that help us to be aware of what our emotions are doing, observing them, sensing them, feeling that safety and support that you spoke about?
Yes. One of the most basic balancing practices that are out there is something in the yoga tradition we refer to as Samavriti. And Samavriti, or same breath, equal breathing. Sama is same, right? Equal. And vritti in Sanskrit refers to the movement. And it's not just the movement of the breath, but it's also the movement of the mind. So when our breath is erratic, often our thoughts are erratic as well. from a yogic perspective, a basic balancing practice would be one that helps us find an equal length of our inhalation and an equal length of our exhalation. And to slow that down enough so that we're now reducing breaths from a typical 12, 13 breaths a minute down to about 5 or 6 breaths a minute. That simple change slows down the mind. Once our mind slows down, we can feel more clarity and focus and mental calmness. That allows us to meditatively focus on the breath. That calms the body. So we have this cycle that ensues that becomes this deeply restorative balancing. And from a nervous system perspective, if we look at what balance is in this sum of riti, the same movement, we're cultivating about an equal amount of time devoted to sympathetic mobilization. We're subtly removing that vagal break, and parasympathetic restoration, where we're reapplying that vagal break. And it's this rhythmic removing and reapplying that allows for something that we call a coherent state or kind of optimal vagal tone. It's measured by something called heart rate variability. And what we see with the breath is that every inhalation keys in just a little bit of our sympathetic nervous system. Every exhalation keys in a little bit of our parasympathetic system. So when we breathe rhythmically for about a count of 4 or 5 on each inhale and a count of 4 or 5 on each exhale, we slow everything down and we create this rhythmic balance inside between the two primary branches of the autonomic nervous system. Hence, we create balance.
Even as you say that and you slow down, and I'm kind of almost practicing that to see what it feels like as you're talking. So I'm like taking in a breath and for 5 seconds and then exhaling it for 5 seconds. And just by doing that once, like it automatically shifts. And you said do 5 cycles, aim for 5 cycles in a minute. Really, right?
Yes.
So if we would just do that now, like, could you talk us through just 1 minute of practice? Could you do that?
My pleasure. My pleasure. Yeah. And, you know, the first place that I always begin with any practice is the invitation to pause for a moment and just orient to what are you bringing with you into this practice? What is the state of mind that you're currently in? The felt sense in your body, if you're comfortable turning toward that. What are the emotions that are present for you today? How is your breath before we even go into change your breath, how is your breath showing up for you today? How are you breathing? And then noticing kind of energetically how does that give you feedback about your nervous system? Do you feel spacey and dispersed? Do you feel heavy, fatigued? And when we go into this mindful inquiry, it is so important to go in without judgment, to go in with curiosity, so that you can simply be aware and to know that there is no bad or wrong nervous system state. They all are holding information and wisdom for you that you can listen to, and it will help to guide you. So now with the foundation of self-awareness, you might even take a moment to slightly adjust your posture or to find a seat that feels comfortable and supported for you, maybe a long spine. And then from there, we go into the balancing breath. And even just in these next 5 breaths to start to notice what begins to shift. So I'll invite you to start with an inhale for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and exhale 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And again, inhale 2, 3, 4, 5, And exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5. Inhaling and exhaling. Once again, finding your rhythm, listening and letting go. And one more inhale and exhale. And then letting go of the guided practice and noticing what is present for you now. Without judgment, is creating space.
Wow, that's really just so powerful just to do that for a minute. It's like that minute expands. And I didn't think I was tense. And now I realize I was a little tense.
Yeah, I can see the difference in your face and your shoulders dropped like 2 inches.
I know. I'm like, gosh. Well, you know, and that's the power of this, isn't it? Because, and that's what I love about your work and your practices, is that they seem simple, but they're so incredibly powerful in a short space of time. And we can do that at any time, whether it's a scheduled practice in the morning or during the day or before we go to bed, or whether it's in response to being triggered during the day and we need to kind of just balance ourselves and pause before we respond to something, yeah. Right?
And one thing that I just feel like is so worthy of mention here, Kathy, is that I've been teaching these breath practices now for, oh goodness, about 30 years. I started teaching yoga in 1994 and I did my official teacher training in 1996, but this has been, you know, a practice of mine for a very long time. And the, you know, having taught thousands and thousands of people how to breathe, there is inevitably someone in the room that will say to me, breathing makes me anxious. As soon as I bring my attention to my breath, I start to feel uncomfortable. What should I do? And so I really want to name this for our listeners that the initial response to breath isn't always one of ease and deep relaxation or balance. That when we are breathing in this manner, we are functionally opening up the communication network between the brain and the body, the mind and the body. And so if our body has been carrying a whole lot of tension, or if we have been in some way or another, you know, compartmentalizing our emotions, and we start to breathe in this way, we will feel more of what is here for us. And sometimes what we feel is what we've been dissociating from or pushing away or disconnecting from. And we might feel the vulnerability that's now ready to come to the surface of our awareness. So the first thing I want to say is that if that occurs when you do conscious breathing, you're not doing conscious breathing wrong. It's actually a sign that you are doing conscious breathing and that you've awakened your mind-body connection. Then the question becomes, do I have the resources that will support me to be with or digest or process what comes up in the journey of breathing? And other things that we can keep in mind along the way is that breathing also will illuminate chronic tension patterns that we carry in our body. And it's really, really common to have tension around our breathing apparatus, whether that's our diaphragm or our rib cage or our lungs or our upper chest and neck and throat. And so as we breathe and we slow down the breath, we're also inviting a little bit more movement into the diaphragm, into the rib cage to take that deep, full breath. And on that longer exhalation, we're contracting through the intercostals in the ribs. We're allowing the diaphragm to draw upward. That deeper, fuller breath is something that many of us don't do on a day-to-day basis. We breathe more shallowly or we breathe imperceptibly. Maybe we only do upper chest breathing and we don't soften the diaphragm because we've been, you know, told that we need to suck that in order to fit a certain look in the world, right? So it can bring up discomfort perhaps before it feels more intuitive.
Yeah, and to that point, and I'm so glad you highlighted that now, what would you suggest as some support and resourcing tools for people as they go through these processes? So whether it's a calming practice or an energizing practice or one of your balancing practices, when stuff comes up, we have on call, if you like, we've already identified some resourcing and support tools.
Yes. I think that, you know, maybe the most basic tool that I love to offer around how to ground ourselves when something does get triggered or activated in a practice is what we call an orienting practice. And an orienting is consciously focusing your attention on the cues of safety and connection that are there for you in your current environment. And that often when we feel triggered, we are feeling more sensation internally, that we are more aware of the activation as it lives inside of our bodies. So we orient our attention back externally to the cues in our environment. Maybe it's a piece of art on your wall. Maybe it's something you can hold in your hand, or it's an essential oil that you can smell. Maybe it's getting outside and putting your feet on the ground, your bare feet on the ground. For you, maybe out on the beach, right? Listening to the sound of the waves. Maybe it is splashing your face with cold water. Any of those orienting practices bring us back into the present moment. And the truth is that when we're triggered by trauma, we're getting pulled into trauma time. We're reawakening into things that happened in the past. And in this present moment, if indeed you're safe enough in the here and now, we want to reorient our attention to those cues that let us know that we're safe in the here and now.
Yeah, and then let's talk about energizing practices. And also, I just, you know, as you were talking, you know, as we're talking about practices that can ground us, is it helpful for people also to then jump into an energizing practice, like right away, to offset that and kind of lift us into an energized place beyond, you know, what else we might be experiencing?
I love that you asked that. It's exactly where I wanted to go next. And yes, it is extraordinarily helpful for many, many people. I will never say that it's always, you know, one answer for everyone, but I will say that for many, many people, when we feel overwhelmed, coming back into a shape with our bodies, where we can really sense and feel our empowerment in the here and now, right? There's this lovely research out there by Amy Cuddy about this idea of power poses. And yoga has built right into it these power poses where you're taking a larger shape with your body. Maybe it's standing in a wide stance and your arms are out wide. Maybe it's a classic warrior two pose, right? Maybe it's a five-pointed star shape. But in one of these shapes, what we're doing is we're saying, I can take up space now. It's okay for me to be here. I can sense and feel my legs as they press into the ground. I can sense and feel the expanse of my wingspan of my arms. I can lift my gaze rather than, you know, when we think about the shape that we might take when we're afraid, we curl up into a small ball sometimes. We get very small. And so we're counteracting that tendency and we're saying, I can claim my worth, my power, my courage here and now. And you can even hear the difference in my voice tone as I speak about this, right? And, you know, one of my very favorite energizing practices in the yogic tradition is something we call lion's breath, right? And it lets you take on a bit of a fierce shape, right? And a fierce breath. And you can make a sound even with your voice. You can stick out your tongue. You turn your hands into claws, right? And it's super playful. I swear to you, every single time I do this practice, we laugh because it's playful and we can get fierce and playful at the same time. And that's that beautiful intersection of mobilization in the context of safety.
You know, when you said that we can get fierce and playful at the same time, that struck me a lot because, you know, when I have wanted to express, especially vocally and also with taking up space with my body, that sometimes has made me feel very uncomfortable because it feels like it's coming from a place of almost anger and a negative place. And so when you say, you know, express yourself fiercely but playfully, you know, it just struck me as, oh, you know, that's why probably when I do some of the poses that you suggest and vocalize it, because I've put in my mind, oh, this is for an expansive reason, that's probably why I feel more positive and powerful as opposed to fearful of releasing an anger, although expressing anger is also good and therapeutic. But it has been a powerful experience to go through some of your practices and feel the power kind of in the body in a very felt sense by a relatively simple and short power posture, as you said, and vocalizing that. Do you find people have that range of reactions?
Yes, and I find that most of the time these empowering and energizing practices feel a little bit safer than the practices oriented towards stillness or calming. Because, you know, if we shift attention for a moment just to the calming practices, these are the ones that invite us to rest in stillness, to go towards perhaps something more like a restorative or a yin yoga practice or a yoga nidra, a deep relaxation or meditation. And it's in the stillness that I find most people feel the most uncomfortable. Because through the gates of stillness, we are more apt to feel perhaps safe enough to feel where I was once unsafe, or safe enough to feel the tender, vulnerable emotions that I sometimes tuck away. Now, there's actually a tremendous beauty to having access to ourselves in that way. And very often there's also a relief afterwards. But initially, the trauma-informed approach to these quieter side of the practice is to have anchors of what we would call kind of that ventral vagus cues of safety, or anchors of the here and now cues that let us know that we're safe. An anchor might be a memory of a time when you felt so deeply peaceful and at ease in the world, like, you know, walking on the beach, or for me here in Colorado, walking in my favorite trails in the mountains. I feel so safe there. So I can take that cueing memory of safety and the feeling that gives me in my body with me, so that even if I close my eyes, even if I rest into deep stillness, I can still recall the felt sense of safe enough to let go of that protective defensive stance, the vulnerability of the soft belly, the vulnerability of the exhalation.
Yeah, and this is why it's so great to talk to you through this, is that even just as we went through in a relatively short time, you know, those different exercises, you know, balancing and then imagining an energizing experience and then reflecting on a calming experience, what I'm feeling even now is, oh, you know, we can move through a range of emotions and it's okay. You know, we have that capacity to actually very quickly go from a balanced state to an energized state to a calming state. And I kind of just having a moment, you know, that we sometimes forget that, you know, or we get stuck in a particular negative emotion and think, oh, how on earth am I going to move myself out of this? And I think what this highlights is that there are some very simple things that we can do to move ourselves through that range of emotion, and we can be in the driver's seat, and we can regulate that, and we can make choices, and we can practice every day so that it becomes more of the norm of how we move through each day. And it's not so much of a struggle to do that.
I love the way that you just encapsulated it. In the applied polyvagal theory and yoga model, what I refer to this process is cultivating nervous system flexibility, so that I don't get stuck in any one nervous system state, and that I have the ability to move between balancing, energizing, and calming states with greater choice, with greater will, self-control, if you want to use that word. I love the driver's seat metaphor. It is something that, to me, is the most empowering experience when we no longer feel driven by our nervous system, but we get to be in partnership with it. And maybe the last thing I'll name here is that for me, nervous system flexibility is the physiological basis for resilience.
Talk to us more about that.
Yes. Yeah. So from a resilience standpoint, when we experience trauma, we have the ability to, in a sense, adapt to whatever that stressor was, whatever that traumatic event was, to know that I have the capacity to, in a sense, kind of ride through the emotional waves in relationship to it, to not get stuck in that shutdown, or to not get stuck in that fright state or that freeze state, but to be able to be adaptable. That's resilience. And when you look at the research on trauma, Kathy, most of the research shows us that really only about 20% of us in the face of trauma develop post-traumatic stress disorder. We all might have what we think of as kind of an acute traumatic stress response, an immediacy of that traumatic stress response. That's very normal. It's normal to feel shaky or to not sleep or to feel afraid or to feel sad after we experience something scary. But what we want to know is that with resilience, that we can have access to the resources that help us get out of those traumatizing states back into a sense of competence and confidence that I can handle it now. And that perhaps even beyond resilience, that I can grow in relationship to hardship, that I can find what we call post-traumatic growth, and perhaps even recognize that I'm stronger than I realized I was.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I'm so glad you highlighted post-traumatic stress versus post-traumatic stress disorder, because I think, you know, for me personally, and just, you know, talking amongst others, you know, that word disorder can be so disempowering, you know. And I know, you know, I experience post-traumatic stress, you know, in different ways every day, as we're all triggered. But feeling that it's not a disorder, that it's just part of our growth and journey, and to be in that space of awareness and embracing it to grow, you know, I think it's so important that people don't feel like they've necessarily got a disorder or a mental illness, you know, that it's part of the growth. And actually, in fact, I think the stats show that the majority of people, you know, don't have a mental illness. There's a growth beyond trauma and the symptoms that show up each day. Would that be fair to say?
100%. We're on the same page. And I think it's such an incredibly important message to get out there. Because if we don't know that it's normal to feel a certain degree of stress and emotional distress and so forth, then we think there's something wrong with us. And I can't tell you how many people have come to me saying, I must be broken. There must be something wrong with me. I feel crazy inside. And that when we can actually just pull in what you're feeling is a human experience, and it's welcome here, and you're not crazy and you're not broken, but you are human and you're hurt and you're in need of support, that it just takes that extra layer of worry out of the equation so that we can attend to ourselves with profound compassion.
And that point, as we wrap up, tend to ourselves with profound compassion. A large part of your work highlights that we need to be self-compassionate. We need to have self-love deeply for us to keep going through this healing process and resist the temptation to beat ourselves up along the way that we're not progressing well enough or fast enough or doing the postures right. It's, you know, just lighten up on ourselves, love ourselves through this process.
Yes. When, you know, if you were to ask me what is my favorite practice, what is, do I believe is perhaps the most important practice, it is self-compassion. And from a yogic perspective, it's an embodiment of that self-compassion so that it doesn't just become an idea in the mind, which can be hard to grasp, but that we can anchor self-compassion in how we're turning towards our felt sense, how we are literally holding ourselves, that creates the grounding of that self-compassion beyond an idea into a way of being.
And as you were saying that, I saw you do that butterfly hug to yourself, which is one of your postures, which is so beautiful, just kind of that butterfly hug of ourselves with kind of self-compassion and love. Ariel, thank you so, so much. Is there anything in closing that you would like to say further? I know we had a limited amount of time today, and of course, I'll direct everyone to your website and of course, your flip chart and your upcoming book in April. But any final thoughts and insights and wisdom to share?
You know, I just want people to know that you are welcome to find my YouTube channel. I have created that as what I called my pandemic project, and it's just continued ever since 2020 in the sense that I have put out there at this point hundreds of free resources, full yoga classes, shorter yoga classes, nervous system resources, and that's at Dr. Ariel Schwartz on YouTube. You can also find it on my website and other resources for trauma recovery as well as my books. Kathy, thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It means all of your work. So, so grateful. Thank you. To receive notifications of the podcast, subscribe or follow the podcast today and visit overcomingchildsexualabuse.com for more about this and upcoming podcasts. Remember, to get help for anything you're going through, reach out to a qualified professional. You can search the internet, call 24/7 hotlines, including the National Child Abuse Hotline, or speak to your doctor for resources. In case of a mental health emergency, please don't hesitate to call 911.